This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Corporate Service Supply and Manufacturing, a DJI Enterprise dealer providing DJI equipment and support for law enforcement, public safety, construction, and other commercial users of unmanned aerial systems. To learn more, visit the uavdigest.com/css. And by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the uavdigest.com/goengineer. You're listening to episode 266 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max, it's good to be back recording after our small hiatus. I hope all of our listeners had a good Thanksgiving holiday if they celebrated it.
Yes, for sure. It is good to be back, though.
Routine is important. Well, we got a lot of good stories this week. We've got Piaggio and the end of the Hammerhead. Disappointing about that. China's Great Wall is crumbling, so send in the drones. Why is it so incredibly hard to attach a parachute to a drone? Something about rapidly rotating scissors kind of
thing. Yeah.
We got some listener mail. And drone rules still likely years away, dragging on industry growth. Oh, another complaint piece. So I guess we should get started. What do you think?
All right, David, let's get started.
Well, our first news this week is terribly disappointing, which is Piaggio Aerospace seeks receivership. Now, if you haven't listened to Airplane Geeks or this show, you will need to know that the official airplane of the Airplane Geeks is the Piaggio Avanti, which is a two-engine pusher aircraft that just looks really, really beautiful. And in fact, Piaggio converted it to the HH Hammerhead, which was a long endurance, medium altitude UAV.
Yes, the Piaggio aircraft are, well, they look like Italian aircraft from a design standpoint. And it's unfortunate here that we see that they've been asked to go into receivership. Now, the Italian Air Force was to be the launch customer for the Hammerhead, and we understand they had ordered three systems, but there were some troubles along the way. Of course, remember, David, the prototype crashed. That was back in 2016, I think. Don't know if that contributed to the problems of the company or the thoughts of the Italian Air Force in terms of taking that aircraft on. But it looks like they're going down, but it is Italy, and the Italian government is always very concerned about jobs. So we might see some kind of government step in, perhaps.
I don't know if the government of Italy can afford to step in.
Yeah, but that doesn't usually stop them, David.
Agreed. But, that's a challenging economy, and it pulls down a lot of other economies.
Yeah, yeah.
I also know that there was some interest in the Middle East for the Hammerhead. They really were trying to push it in some of the Gulf states. It was an interesting concept, taking a full-size aircraft and converting it into a UAV. And that being said, the ability to change all of the interiors and make it a multi-purpose UAV and modular kind of it. Piaggio had a good step, but I do think, Max, the accident did have a negative impact on the aircraft, which is unfortunate because the Avanti is a very beautiful aircraft.
Yeah, yeah. The manned version, the P-180, that had previously been sold to a Chinese company. So Piaggio had taken some steps previously to try to keep the company going. But I guess that just wasn't enough.
Yeah, so if you ever get a chance and see a Piaggio, it they sound amazing because of the pusher propellers. But we'll lament that the best airplane that we liked on Airplane Geeks that became a drone is probably not going to happen. So, but we've got a you've got to be kidding files. Audi and Airbus, the idea of future is modular drone taxis. When are we just going to rebrand this the Aerial Taxi Show, Max?
I know, it feels like we should. This is an interesting matchup. It's Audi, Airbus, and Ital Design. And this modular concept is that there's an autonomous vehicle, a car, that has a cab, and the car can drive itself and you in the cab to a location where the drone is. Now, this is a big drone, and the cab disengages from the autonomous vehicle and is captured by the drone, and then it flies you off to your destination.
Seems to me I've seen this in the 50s. I don't know what to say. I don't want to say it's you got to be kidding, because it's in a way warped sort of way, Max. We do it all the time. Have you seen how we load airliners with cargo? We have a cab, and the cab comes off the truck, and the truck slides into the airplane, and away you go. Or if you know anything about overland transport and railroads, you have trucks that take containers off of a ship, and it goes onto a train, and then that container gets transferred to a truck, and that truck gets delivered to a house. So, and if we're going to talk about the aerial component, Sikorsky has been living this for years. The Sikorsky Sky Crane was designed to carry modules, especially one of the most important one was literally a mobile hospital that connected to the helicopter. The helicopter moved it, dropped it off where it was needed. Likewise, the C-82 Packet was another aircraft that was designed by Fairchild Aircraft, which was a modular design that came along and you picked up the package and you moved it over. So the technology's all there. It's not autonomous yet, and it's not unbelievable. I hate to say it.
Well, it's interesting that Airbus is part of this. The Audi and Ital Design component, that makes a certain amount of sense. Since I think 2010, Lamborghini owns Ital Design, and Lamborghini is a subsidiary of Audi. So there's that connection there. So they're working with Airbus, and they've been testing in South America, along with Airbus subsidiary Voom. But again, it's a modular system. There's the flight module, the cabin module, and the road module. But recently they demonstrated this concept with a 1/4 scale model during Drone Week in Amsterdam. The president of Ital Design said that flying taxis are on the way. He said, "We at Audi are convinced of that. More and more people are moving to cities, and more people will be mobile thanks to automation. In the future, senior citizens, children, and people without a driver's license will want to use conventional robot taxis. If we succeed in making a smart allocation of traffic between roads and airspace, people in cities can benefit in equal measure." So there's a video that they've produced, and we'll put that in the show notes. You can watch them right from the website. And it shows the engineers constructing and testing the different components of this. And again, this is the small-scale model. It's kind of interesting to watch this video and how these German engineers are making some progress here. But I don't know. I understand the dream behind this, David, and all the similar autonomous taxi efforts underway. But I don't know. It just feels like there's such a big jump between the dream and a feasible implementation of these things.
That's what they said about the Wright brothers.
That's true.
And they're getting a very, very large monument now in the state of Ohio. Wonder what they're doing in Connecticut for Mr. Gustav.
Gustav Whitehead's memorial is a little teeny tiny thing. I think it's down in Bridgeport. Very small. I'll have to visit that to see if I can get a selfie with me and the Gustav Whitehead memorial. But
I think, Max, but that's partly why we like this industry. We can't not say that this industry doesn't dream big.
That's true. Yep.
I mean, it's kind of impressive, you know. We dream big. So some of this stuff isn't going to work, but there's no harm trying because you never know. It might work, you know. And I think it would be kind of interesting to see that if this would be an amazing thing for travel that's, you know, not necessarily your local taxi drive, but say you want to go from, I live in Philadelphia, I want to go to New York. I mean, this would be an amazing way to do it, and for that longer distance, but not, you want to get on a super train or a airliner, but you know, the 2 hour taxi ride might be only a 15 minute taxi ride, you know, especially during traffic. So we'll see. But, you know, I mean, there are walls and there are, applications that need to be worked through, and there might be some cracks. But which that leaves me to my next segue, which is China's Great Wall is crumbling and drones are being used to save it. This is from the New Zealand Herald. Chinese authorities are using drones to map and measure sections of the Great Wall of China. Now, that is one of the only wonders of the world that can be seen from space. So it's kind of a big wall.
It is. Actually, it's a series of walls. People have this idea that it's like this one big, long, single wall, and it's not. It's sort of a network of walls. But if you add up the lengths of all of them, you're talking about thousands of miles. And some of the walls are restored around the tourist areas, like, for example, around Beijing, I know because I've seen that, where the wall is meticulously restored. But it is not constructed of, you know, uniform materials. In some places, the wall is just made out of wood and mud. It's not all the large stone structure that, you know, we see in the photos. So they say as much as 30% of the walls are in really bad shape and are crumbling. And with all these thousands of miles, I mean, it's almost like, you know, the pipeline problem where you've got a lot of miles of something that you need to survey. So according to the BBC, they've actually been using the data that have been collected by the drone flights to make some improvements to build some support structures and things like that. So this is, I think, a great way to deal with a problem that, I mean, how are you going to physically inspect, you know, thousands of miles of, you know, structure? So this is great. And, of course, something like the Great Wall of China, I mean, that's something that you want to preserve and not just crumble away to nothing.
Yeah, not to mention it keeps DJI occupied. That's who's they're using for, I mean, let's face it, they've got enough drones over there to do this. But yeah, no, it's whether you're pro-China or not or whatever, you have to admit that the China Wall is one of mankind's greatest architectural designs. It's an amazing piece of architecture. Hopefully someday I'll get to see it in person. But, I mean, it's a historical landmark for the rest of, and I'm glad to see that the Chinese government is recognizing it and trying to do the best they can to retain it as part of their heritage.
Yes.
So the next article, my co-host put into it because, you know, he likes these things like, how do you make an egg fall from the sky and not crack? That's the typical engineering scientific experiment that this goes on. So Popular Mechanics, hard to believe they're still around.
Yeah, they're going strong.
Why is it so incredibly hard to attach a parachute to a drone? Okay, Max, why is it so terribly hard to attach a parachute to a drone? Could it be whirling rotor blades?
Yeah. Actually, despite the headline, it's easy to attach a parachute to a drone. But the problem is that if you have an equipment failure, like one of the motors fails, well, then the drone goes unstable. And if you just toss out a parachute in that kind of situation where the drone is falling and tumbling, there's a good chance that the functional rotors are going to slice up your parachute. And that's been a problem in some cases. So a company named Indemnis has a solution. And what they do is they have a tube. So when the parachute is activated, either because the drone itself decides that it's in trouble and in need of a parachute recovery, or if the operator initiates it, what happens is a tube inflates very, very quickly, extending away from the drone itself, and then the parachute shoots out of the end of that tube. So the parachute is outside of the range of the whirling blades.
Sounds like just a plain old ejection seat to me. And let's face it, parachutes are important. This week, we actually used a supersonic parachute to put a drone on Mars, the InSight lander. So it is kind of funny because an ejection seat works the way where you eject out of the aircraft, but your parachute doesn't deploy until you're away from the aircraft. This sounds a little bit the same way. You know, it's not like our rockets that just popped the cone off and gravity opened up the chute. This is definitely something to push it away from the aircraft. What I thought was interesting, though, is you lose one engine and you deploy the chute. What happens if the other engines are going?
Yeah, I think you'd want to shut them off.
That's what I'm saying. And we're talking about this being a drone doing this autonomously. I would hope there's some sort of tickle switch as the drone deploys the parachute that it turns off the motors.
Well, that's interesting because if you follow
I always have to push the envelope and go, okay, well, why didn't you think of this?
Yeah, of course, if you can just shut off the motors, then why do you need the tube, right? Well, I don't know. They had to search for some material to make this tube out of that was appropriate, and they settled on this stuff called Dyneema, I guess is how you pronounce it. It's a fiber. Say it's 15 times stronger than steel. But if you have a sheet of this stuff and you want to make a tube, you've got to attach it to itself. And apparently this material doesn't want to attach to itself. So they had to get a little bit fancy with how it was attached. But they got it to work. They say this tube inflates at 30 psi in 30 milliseconds, and the launch velocity of the parachute coming through the tube is 90 miles an hour. So there's some videos on their website that you can watch, and the thing pops right out. Seems pretty effective.
Unlike the current FAA regulations.
Which are not quick.
Which are not quick or effective, evidently. This is from the wallstreetjournal.com, and we apologize if you are looking at this a couple years from now and cannot find it behind the paywall. Drone rules likely years away, dragging on industry's growth. The FAA regulations for BVLOS, flights over people, night flying, etc., are taking a long time. Well, we've been doing this almost 5 years now, Max.
It feels like a long time.
It feels like a long time. Feels like 10.
Well, some of the trade association leaders are thinking that, you know, it might be 2022 before all this gets sorted out. There's some quotes in the Wall Street Journal article. Brian Wynn, the president and chief executive of AUVSI, says, "I'm not happy about it." The chairman and chief executive of KESPRI, George Matthew, says there's been a process of kicking the can down the road. Now, the FAA course says, well, we have to get this right the first time. We're moving as quickly as possible to address the complex issues, which I think that's true as well.
I don't think anybody's going to be happy with anything until something. The industry is going to push and push the FAA until they come out with something. And then they're going to be really upset when something goes wrong. And they're going to say, well, why didn't the FAA know about this in advance? So I'm kind of getting tired of saying this is a rock and a hard place. It's where we are. We've got almost 50 years of drone development that have occurred since we started doing this podcast for almost 5 years. That's an acceleration that the FAA isn't used to, nor I think anybody else is, with maybe the exception of the computer industry. And let's face it, we've got things like social media issues now where the technology has gotten so far advanced that the government doesn't know where to start to be able to regulate it to begin with. So I don't think we should dwell on this much other than, yeah, it's coming. I'm still kind of sympathetic with the FAA because they are trying to get it right. But I do understand the concerns of like Brian Wynn, who we welcome to come on the show, or George Matthew, also we welcome to come on the show. Let's face it, folks. This is a tough challenge, but I have to admit, there's no other industry that's working as well as they can with the federal government to get advancements in safety and prosperity, et cetera. So we need to be proud of that aspect, even though it's not going at the time frame we want it to.
And I think one of the areas that's causing a great deal of time to be taken is the drone identification system. I mean, the public service agencies want to see ID systems for drones. A number of other groups do as well. There's a lot of compelling reasons why people want to be able to identify a specific drone or a specific operator. And that's a problem that, or an issue that is only more recently, I think, being worked on and getting the attention that it needs. I mean, there were other technical issues a few years ago that were being addressed and are still being addressed, sense and avoid and things like that. But this remote drone identification issue is something that it just feels like we haven't been working on that for as long. And that's a key part of this whole puzzle, I think, in the minds of many people. So getting that worked out is a challenge. And when these folks look at the situation, look at the landscape and think that, well, you know, it's going to be 2022 before this all comes together, I think that's a big piece of it. But yeah, I agree with what you say, David. And I mean, certainly if you have an agency like the FAA, what's their charter? Their charter is to ensure that, you know, safety in the air. If safety is your charter, is your goal, your mandate, then that's going to drive caution by definition. And caution means time. So, yeah, 2022 sounds about right to me.
Well, that gives us another 4 years of podcasting. I mean, what the hell?
All right. We have some feedback, David.
We do. One is from our co-host from Airplane Geeks, Brian, interlocking brick system micro quad. And this, we've talked about this, I guess, two Christmases ago about a company called G-Max, and they can use they have a quad system that mounts to my favorite thing in the world, Legos. Okay, my second favorite thing in the world, Legos. Oh, and by the way, we didn't talk about the Ion Drive.
No. You know, and we did get a lot of feedback from folk. We talked about that on Airplane Geeks. So for the three of you, maybe who haven't
who don't listen to both shows?
No, or don't read the news. Some folks at MIT created a small unmanned aircraft that actually uses ion drive. So there are no moving parts. And they've tested this. They've flown this indoors in it was a gymnasium, I think, wasn't it, David?
Yeah.
And they call it solid state propulsion. There's ions are created, and the sort of the flow of ions from one charge to another creates kind of like a little wind that provides propulsion. Now, they have a lot of work to do to, you know, to make this a realistic kind of a technology that's actually useful. I think they're not at all convinced that that's going to happen, but it might. But one of the things they're thinking about, if it does prove workable, is...
We've got whisper quiet drones.
Yeah, exactly. And we've been talking about how do you get rid of that buzzing sound that you know, the drones make, that it can be irritating if there's just one or two drones around. But picture a neighborhood with, or a city, an urban area with these things flying all over the place. And I just think the racket would be unacceptable. So one of the applications they're kind of thinking about is that if these things, this ion drive could power drones, then, you know, you solve that noise problem. So that part of it has me pretty intrigued.
And like I said, for the three people, if you've heard this already on Airplane Geeks, I'm sorry, but I was really disappointed at MIT, because if they paid attention a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, there were these things called TIE fighters. And TIE, believe it or not, does not stand for the shape of the aircraft, but stands for twin ion energy. And twin ion engines. Why is that so hard to say all of a sudden? Twin ion engines. So I was, you know, I have to get my Star Trek licks in every so often. And that was like there. But so it's a good episode, Max. I got Legos, I got Star Wars, you know, and it's a good episode. But let's move on to Marcus, who said, quote, "I recently listened to episode 264, and the chapter about the Robur drone reminded me of something similar that has developed a few years ago by the company Festo. The Smart Bird project, take a look here." And we'll have a link, of course, to the show notes. Festo was inspired by a herring gull, and this takes place down in Germany.
Yeah, and Marcus wonders if this smart bird, because it's got some similarity to the Robur, you know, was there some kind of collaboration here, or was there some kind of you know, exchange of knowledge between Festo and ClearFlight Solutions? And I don't know what the answer to that question is, but I tell you, when you look at the smart bird videos that Festo had created, and I think this is not a key part of their business these days. I think they really do, you know, other things. I don't think they're really a drone company. But one thing, David, when you look at the smart bird videos, it's really an elegant looking, even more bird-like kind of shape, I think, than what we saw with the Robur. It's really kind of you know, beautiful.
Birds are beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
Birds are beautiful and elegant. There's been an old meme around for a long time of a picture of looking directly sideways at a peregrine falcon, and above it is the side profile of a flying B-2, stealth bomber, the flying wing. And the shapes are almost down to their beaks. The B-2 has a little bit of a beak on their leading edge. They look identical. So, you know, birds are beautiful, you know. And we know the drones are going to want to mimic birds, because we also know that they are trying to get hummingbird action into drones, you know. So you get the hovering, et cetera, besides the ability to glide and stuff. So nature got it right. We're just trying to copy it. And when we get it right, sure enough, it looks a lot like nature did it the first time.
Yes. All right. Well, I think with that, we'll wrap it up. I want to thank you for listening to episode 266 of the UAV Digest. As always, you can find our website at theuavdigest.com. If you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, well, they're at theuavdigest.com/266. And there you'll find links to all the news stories, the companies we talked about, some of the videos that we mentioned. You can watch those right there at the website.
So you can find us on social media at Twitter, at UAV Digest, on Facebook at facebook.com/theUAVDigest. to our Slack team, which is growing in leaps and bounds every week. Like to welcome all of our new listeners to the Slack team. Anybody else? There's plenty of room. The pool's big. We'd love for you to dive in. You can do that by sending in a request to join it at the UAV Digest, feedback@theuavdigest.com. And either Max or I will send you an invite. You can join us on Facebook. We'll just look up UAV Digest. And of course, you can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Podcasts or any of your other podcast catchers. What we do ask, though, is if you do listen to them, do us a favor and leave some feedback saying you like the show so other people can find us, so we can continue to grow and get the reputation that we have so that we can find more guests and better content for you. So I guess with that, I'm going to say this is David in Fort Washington.
And Max in Hartford.
Thank you for listening.